With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Hello, welcome to the show, going twice weekly for you now. The Phil Hay Show, brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. This is the Friday show where we react to Jesse Marsh's press conference. Phil, you've just hot-footed it from Thorpe Arch down to the studio for us to do that. And before we get into that, just to let you know, the Monday show is where we react to the weekend's game.
Yeah, and also to say that it might well be that the Friday show comes a little bit later to you than normal. I know people, certainly in the UK, are looking out for it first thing on a Friday morning, but there is a ridiculous run of Sunday matches through September and October. And in fact, from, I think, the Brentford game away down in London at the start of September, right the way through to the start of November, we don't have a single Saturday match, which means the press conferences usually take place on a Friday. And because we'd like to bring you what's been said in them and discuss what's been said in them, we might be coming to you a little bit later than usual.
Yep. I'm back from my holidays. Dan Moylan here from The Square Ball with Michael, also from The Square Ball, who did hosting duties while I was away.
Enjoyed it an awful lot.
I listened to the shows that took place during my absence on the way in. Great. Did a good job.
Any criticisms? Anything that made you cringe?
Absolutely.
Want to smash up your mixing deck?
All completely passable.
Excellent.
Just.
I absolutely don't want to hear criticism anyway.
And of course, Phil Hay from The Athletic. Enough about us, about The Athletic. You can sign up now to read Phil's writings. There's loads of stuff, obviously, about football, sport from around the world. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod is our URL. Pound a month for 6 months. Phil, this week on the site?
We've had a good look at the defending of Marsh's side so far, particularly what's going on out wide, and regular listeners to the podcast will not be surprised to find what is in there. A look at set pieces as well, which have been quite a feature of the first couple of weeks. And if you want some rubbernecking, there's a great long read on what people think of Manchester United presently.
Is the answer not a lot?
They think a lot, but not very much of it complimentary, put it that way.
Still time for you to catch up with the bonus episode that we did that's on the podcast feed, where Phil went and spoke to Andrea Radrazzani as well at Thorpe Arch with David Ornstein. That's on the feed. You can see the video on YouTube as well. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod if you want to sign up and read all Phil's stuff on The Athletic. Right, and you have come from Thorpe Arch ahead of the Chelsea game, the Chelsea presser. Quite a lot to go at from that. So where do you want to start then? Team news.
Yes. So the big question marks are over Liam Cooper and Patrick Bamford, although I suspect reading between the lines there aren't actually question marks over either. Marsh did say it would be a decision taken on Saturday about Bamford, but I think between both his comments and also what Bamford said on the official Leeds United podcast, which was that he was kind of expecting to miss the Chelsea game, I think the likelihood is that we won't be seeing him, and I don't think we'll be seeing Cooper either.
How are you? How are you feeling?
Yeah, all right, to be fair. I've got a slight groin injury, so I'll probably miss maybe the Chelsea game.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's just part and parcel of kind of coming back. Obviously, I barely played last year and barely trained actually as well. I reckon the amount of times I trained from when I first got injured to the end of the season was probably less than 10, like actually with the team.
Wow.
So just basically like a whole year out. So I think it's just getting used to it again. And until Saturday when I just felt it a little bit, I was feeling all right.
We're going to go in depth a bit more on Patrick Bamford, actually, in part two. So let's park that for the minute then. But in terms of team news then, getting there, aren't we? We're getting there.
Yes. No Firpo this weekend either. No Luke Ayling. But Marsh said that they are getting better and better and that he thinks they're probably a week away, 2 weeks away. I would have thought it'll be kind of early September. They might both be back involved.
It feels like Junior Firpo is always 2 weeks away from playing for Leeds United.
I kind of thought that when he said that today as well. It has been a bit like that. And in the end, it's probably going to be the time frame they were talking about back when he injured himself after the Blackpool game. They were thinking 8 weeks initially. Then it seemed like it was going to be quicker and the progress had been better. But he's not so dissimilar to Bamford in a fitness sense. He played a lot more than Bamford last season, but he did have COVID and he did have injuries and it was very stop-start for him. And he's also missed an awful lot of the summer. And because of that, and because of the absence of a full run through pre-season, he's probably going to have the same thing as Bamford, where, you know, Bamford did have a full pre-season and did train a lot during it. But Firpo is going to be coming back into this right in the thick of a Premier League season, which, you know, gets going at a pretty fast pace in August, but does intensify as it goes on. So we're going to have to watch with interest, I think, to see how he adapts. But they are at least on the way back, and Marsh seems happy with Sinisterra's fitness. Most other players, with the exception of Dallas, seem to be either over the hill in terms of recovery or very much getting there. So the squad isn't far off being full strength, but there are still key players, Cooper and Bamford, who don't look like being available this weekend.
Just to run through some of the notes that I made on the press conference, can you just shed some light on what it's like to be in the room when a question like this is asked, where Marsh reflects on the substitutions against Southampton, which I know you spoke about on Monday. I'm just interested to find out what it's like from a press conference point of view, like where he says we stopped playing on top of this is the 2-0 lead the Leeds had. 38 build-ups before the 2-0 lead, and then afterwards they only had two. It's about managing the game in the right way. There are lessons to learn. Nothing necessarily new there, but so why did that one come back up again?
He raised it, really. It was part of the discussion post-match down at Southampton, particularly because he'd said in the lead-up to the game, away at St Mary's, it's going to be very hot this weekend, we'll try and play in the same way, we'll press aggressively, we'll do all the things we normally do. And because of that, we're going to have to be sensible with substitutions, and we may well benefit as much as we ever have from the fact that you have the freedom to make five now, as opposed to three. And then in the end, made the enforced change of Dan James on for Patrick Bamford in the first half, but not a change he would have wanted to make. And then did nothing with the bench up until it had gone from 2-0 to 2-0. And I think you do find with Marsh that he does get drawn into making these admissions, and he's not scared of admitting that he got it wrong. And there was that tone, I thought, in his post-match press conference where he did say, you know, maybe I could have thought about things a little bit earlier. And then I think today that had moved further towards, yeah, I should have done. You know, I should have changed things when we were 2-0 down. I should have used the bench more. There were ways in which we could have held on to that lead. We could have protected that lead. We could have made sure we came away with the win that I think the performance over an hour should have had. So it's an admission that there were things in the performance that weren't good enough, that there were things ultimately that cost them. And yes, things to work on. And to be quite honest, I do prefer a manager who holds his hands up and admits when things have gone wrong. I always thought Bielsa was very good at that. Actually, almost...
Probably to a fault, actually.
Absolutely to a fault. And occasionally, and you know, more than occasionally, to a degree where you found it hard to agree with. You would sit and listen to him and say, I don't think this is as much your fault as you're making out. You know, his mea culpas were always very, very much self-aimed and placed on his shoulders. But there's a little bit of that with Marsh, I think, and that was what that came down to today. You know, I think that acceptance from him that he did get that wrong, and it was the prevailing view, wasn't it, at the end of the game. I think all of us sat there thinking, I don't understand why it was that when the tide started to turn and Southampton finally came into the game, in part because Hasenhüttl had absolutely loaded his team up with attacking players, why there weren't, you know, proper tactical shifts that involved fresh legs from the bench, and clearly he thinks the same.
Quite self-aware is Marsh, isn't he?
I think so, yeah, and I think he seems to worry what people think about him to a degree. I think he, in the way that he sometimes will check back on himself, like he'll mention, he'll say football and soccer and things, and he'll kind of, I think he still wants people to like him, I think is the best way I could describe it at the moment.
I think it tells you that there's quite an attention or quite a focus on what's been said or what's been written, what's on social media. You'll remember his comments about Bielsa's training methods, the overtraining quote that has kind of followed him around. There was a 2-week gap between one press conference and the next because the international break. Oh no, actually, sorry, not because of international break. I think it had been a postponed fixture, but it left Leeds with an empty fortnight. And it was in the middle of that he did the TalkSport interview, and he said, you know, the players were overtrained. And he addressed that specifically when he sat down at his next press conference, if I recall correctly, before any questions had been asked, quite clearly because what had been said and the criticism of those comments had come back to him. He'd picked up on them. He wanted to address them, wanted to, you know, I think fair to say, wanted to redress some of what he said or the tone of how it had been taken. So yeah, I don't think he's oblivious to what's going on, and I don't often feel that it does a coach much good to pretend that you never get it wrong.
I do feel like he's emerging from the shadow of Bielsa a bit this season, though. It's very much his team, and it feels like not everything he does has to be necessarily compared to Bielsa anymore. Insofar as, I mean, that it is going to happen for a long time because of the success Bielsa had and how good it was, but I don't feel like it is looming over him quite as much as it was.
Yeah, he seems to be getting a tune out of Rodrigo for a start, doesn't he? Because he's pretty taken with him, and he was talking him up in this press conference. He's feeling incredibly confident, said Marsh. He'll be starting, he'll be wearing the captain's armband, and he will be taking penalties. I'm really happy for him. And it's not random that he's the captain either. It's a culmination of him adapting to the league, to me, what we're trying to achieve. The confidence has grown in him massively.
I think he feels like that about the goals as well, that it's not random that goals are coming for Rodrigo. It's probably less random again when you play him at 9 rather than at 10, because it puts him in that zone where chances are going to come a bit more freely. But Marsh's attitude towards this is that Rodrigo is, you know, dug in and what, which is not to say that he wasn't doing this before, but has dug in and worked for him since he became head coach. You remember I wrote about this shortly after Marsh took over, that he added Rodrigo to the leadership group, the senior group of players that they have, as a bit of a foreign voice, I think, because there was a feeling that there wasn't necessarily representation for your foreign players up there, to make sure that it was kind of broad, I guess a broad spectrum, and that was representative of the entire squad. He had Phillips in there, he had Bamford in there, he brought Rodrigo in as well, just a few additional additions to that. And I think it's quite significant that Rodrigo will be captain, only because Bamford is injured and Liam Cooper as well. Cooper would clearly have the armband if he was fit. But there always comes a question, doesn't there, when you're missing your usual suspects and your usual candidates, of who you turn to next. And I don't think mentally it can be a bad thing, this, for Rodrigo. I think he'll feel increasingly valued. They need to get a tune, if they're keeping him, they need to get a tune out of him this season. And even more so if there is this question mark over Bamford's fitness still. You know, if there is this question mark about to what extent Bamford is going to be able to be Leeds United's 9 or Leeds United's goal scorer. If in any way he is compromised this season, then Rodrigo is one of those who has been under pressure to step up for a while and certainly needs to do it now.
He spoke about him as like a 9.5 recently, didn't they? Which I found quite interesting. And it does sort of point to that, not quite knowing where to put him, but maybe when you're playing two up front or one tucked in just behind the other, that maybe that's where his sweet spot might be. And we've seen as well with the comments about a new striker, which we'll get onto the sort of transfery stuff in a bit. I still feel that to balance out our squad effectively, it would be helpful to have a new striker, but we need the right guy. Who is that guy who can meet the standards we need in the squad? From a tactical point of view, it does show that they consider Rodrigo somebody that they can play in both positions, I guess.
Yeah, the 9.5 thing is quite funny, because it does feel as if more and more pigeonholing players is becoming difficult to the point of being impossible. One of our analytical writers, John Muller, did a piece about a fortnight ago where he was analysing each position, but making the point that within a position, so midfielders, fullbacks, centre-backs, whatever, you have about 6 or 7 different variations of what a midfielder can be, whether they're attacking midfielder, whether they're more defensive, whether they like to pull the strings with long passes, short passes, whether they're mostly about regaining possession as opposed to retaining it. And it's a massively wide spectrum. And I'm still not totally certain where exactly Rodrigo sits on it. I think he has the ability to play as a 9, but I think 9.5 is probably about right, because you do feel like being slightly more withdrawn than, say, somebody like Bamford would be, is probably a bit more suited to Rodrigo's game. Having said that, in this system, you do need somebody who will be sniffing for chances in the way that Bamford does.
I've just had an awful flashback to when Peter Ridsdale unveiled Olivier Decore on the pitch some years back, 20 years ago now, let's say, or more, when they held up a shirt with 7.2 on the back, when Peter Ridsdale used to brag about the fees that we were paying, because we're suggesting that Rodrigo's a 9.5. Decore was a 7.2 at that stage.
7.2. It's so funny to think of, you know, the fact that 7.2 million now seems like such a fleeting amount of money, particularly this week, I think, with Morgan Gibbs-White going to Forest for, you know, the combined fee, admittedly, and you know, the total deal, but 40-odd million pounds. It's just gone. It's gone through the ceiling in every respect. But I just to quickly as well go back to something that the Mike was saying about Marsh. I think you're right to reflect on the fact that he does seem to have moved a little bit beyond Bielsa this season. I don't think there is now so much of the attention on what had gone before and the massive change of gears and the fractious attitude towards that, the friction that there was after he first came in. I think people now are judging him more and more on his own tactics, his own squad, his own team. The fact that the signings that have come in have been tailor-made, really, to fit into the system that he wants. It does give him the best possible chance. To a point, I think him talking about new striker was interesting in the sense that he seems to be reflecting what a lot of us are thinking, which is that, yes, one there would be definite benefit of having another one in the squad. But I think he would say himself, and he did almost touch on this really, to say he's not actually far off from having what he thinks he needs.
And when it comes to the new guys, Sinisterra back in the mix for Chelsea, Forshaw is in the mix as well. Other things to think about. Touchline beef. Obviously, we saw Tuchel having a bit of beef at the weekend with Conte, two fiery characters. could him and Marsh, it seems like Marsh enjoys the conflict a little bit, if he is even not allowed on the touchline, because Marsh wasn't sure, was he?
Well, we're not sure at the moment either. I was just having a look before we came on air to see if there'd been any formal decision on that, and it's not clear at all. It surprised me slightly that Marsh talked so out a ton about that and saying, look, he was sent off last weekend, therefore he should not be on the touchline. 100% expected him to just say, well, it's not down to me, and it, you know, makes no real difference. But he clearly wants to see that enforced. And I did think it was a good bit of niggle to get going early on. I mean, Tuchel will probably still be, you know, quietly fuming to a certain degree about everything that went on with Conte last weekend. Although I think I saw quotes from Conte earlier saying that he didn't think Tuchel should get a touchline ban. It all feels a little bit like something and nothing. And obviously Marsh and Bruno Lage have had their, they're coming together as well on the first weekend. But I said then, and you know, Marsh almost admitted this during the press conference, I think you'll see a bit of this with him. I don't think he'll be shy on the touchline at all. And he was joking about the fact that when he was in the States, as he put it, he got thrown out of games so often, he almost had to work on making sure that the team and the squad could look after themselves, irrespective of whether he was there and whatever he was doing, just in case he happened to not be on the touchline. And he was saying he won't be shy of yellow cards. But actually, if you read anything about his assistant, Renny Maric, who's coming, ex Dortmund and Mönchengladbach, he says a lot when he's asked about tactics and everything else. He kind of says, like, the important thing with tactics is not that you have a preordained model, although most teams do. You know, that isn't the essential part of it. It is the ability of players to apply ideas and practices and principles on the pitch and in real time under pressure and when things change in a slightly different way. So that's probably not something to worry about too much. But if you're asking me, do I think there might be more shenanigans on the touchline involving Marsh this season? The answer is yes.
I mean, even the reports of the olive branch to Bruno Lage, there's a bit of passive aggressive behaviour involved in this. It's kind of, it's sort of saying, well, I've sent him an email.
The subject is, I'm sorry you feel that way.
I loved it being an email as well. You know, like, I sort of have it in my head that managers and coaches and scouts and everything else will be on WhatsApp permanently, but you might not get around to checking your email until, you know, 10 o'clock at night, at which point you think, I'm not replying to this. But he was asked, you know, have you had a reply? To which the answer was no. I'm sure he's a busy man.
Were you a bit surprised by how openly Marsh spoke about influencing referees from the sideline? Because he essentially said, sometimes you've got to have a go at referees to make them do what you want.
No, he said that before. I think he said that towards the end of last season when he got yellow carded or was admonished on the side of the pitch. His take on it was that if he is trying to make a point about fouls that aren't going their way or decisions that are wrong or whatever else, or if he feels that the balance of the referee is out of kilter, without wanting to put words in his mouth, the only way in which to get around that is to start bollocking people and to start talking out of turn and getting yourself into trouble. So that's not fresh. It's just that it's unusual to hear a manager say that. It's somewhat contrary to his predecessor. We can say that as well.
And specifically on Chelsea then, they're going to be without Kante. Kovacic is out. Broja's out injured as well. They tend to play wide, don't they? They play like wing backs. So do you think we'll see a shift in the system from Leeds this time?
They do. They use three at the back. They've got players, Cucurella, James. Certainly looked to me from looking at the formation from last weekend that he was more in the line of three at the back than out wide himself. They had Loftus-Cheek in the team also. But Reece gives you a huge amount of overlapping on one side. Cucurella will do that on the other side. Chelsea's second goal against Tottenham very much came from them playing in a way and moving Spurs into a position where Reece was just completely unmarked coming in down the right on that side of the box. And given that the goals Leeds have conceded so far have come from weaknesses in those areas, that I think is where they need to be ultra careful on Sunday. Certainly the first goal at Southampton, very much due to pulling Christensen out of position, opening them up on the left, and because the entire defence had to shift, including Struijk, to cover that side of the pitch, there was nobody there to deal with Aribo when he came in. Walker Peters on the overlap for the second goal, and even going back to Wolves, you know, that goal from Daniel Podence, it all came from kind of half space to half space, if I'm allowed to use that phrase, and from pretty much trying to squeeze Leeds out on the flanks. So I certainly, from watching the goals back, it seemed apparent to me that is a slight problem with this team, which kind of goes without saying that proper analysts will spot that, definitely. And I don't think it would be a surprise at all if you see teams trying to exploit Leeds there.
Will Leeds go three at the back for this, do you think?
A good question, because Marsh, and actually nobody asked that today, but Marsh has shown signs of shifting the team around, certainly did last season. But I suspect that given how it's gone in the first two games, and given that he'll come out of those two games thinking that he should have taken 6 points from them, I think he'll be reluctant to alter it too much in that way.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Patrick Bamford then, Leeds United's number nine, definitely first choice for the position, but where is he at physically? I mean, we played the clip before of him speaking on the club's official podcast up near the start of the show there, and he says he's trained less than 10 times with the full squad after his injury last season, so it feels like he's a way off from being peak Bamford.
Yeah, I don't think him saying that he was kind of expecting to miss the Chelsea game, I don't think much was a revelation. When you saw him coming off at Southampton, your initial thought was that that's going to be at best a little while, as in, you know, possibly a couple of weeks. I wasn't anticipating Marsh saying afterwards, oh, I think he'll be back in training next week, and clearly he's not ready. What I think probably shines a bigger light on this is him saying that from the point of his first injury, and I think I've got that right, his first injury back in September away at Newcastle to the end of the season, he trained, he reckoned, fewer than 10 times with the full squad, which gives you, I think, a very, very vivid impression of how little work he's been able to do and how little his body will have been able to keep up with the day-to-day stress that footballers are used to having in training. And therefore, you have the knock-on effect, and no surprise to anybody, that there is the impact of niggles and strains and everything that comes with the body trying to readjust to, you know, a full-on athlete's life. And it's a concern. I felt almost that what happened at Southampton crystallised the debate about a new striker, not because of numbers. The numbers in any case, I think, are light personally. I think they could do with another nine, someone who can play as a centre forward. But because all of a sudden you did have to ask yourself, how much can Bamford contribute this season? And I don't think it's fair at all to look at him and say not very much. He could still have a big year. But on the basis that we're two games in and already he has this groin issue and already he's missing games and he's going to have another period where he doesn't train fully and he gets himself back up to speed, it is a worry. And I think it's only prudent and only sensible to ask, is that something that you need to mitigate for and you need to cover? And I think that it is.
Well, I've pulled the stats, the post-promotion stats on Bamford. Had a look at them a little bit earlier on. First season back, 2020-2021, he played 3,062 minutes, which is the equivalent of a total of 34 games out of the 38, or averages out to over 80 minutes per game. So a huge contribution. You've only got Dallas, Aylin and Melier played more minutes in that first season back. He scored 17 goals, which was a goal every 180 minutes, a 1-in-2 striker for the minutes that he played, which is very, very good. Last season, 21-22, he played 559 minutes, which is the equivalent of just over six games. He played an average of 14.7 minutes per game across the season. So you can see what we've lost there, can't you? It's the lowest actual total minutes of any of the senior players that are in the squad. One little interesting side note on that is that Joe Gelhart only played 738, so not a great deal, and a great deal many more actually. And this season, 112 minutes so far.
But Gelhart, of course, is at the age that he's at, and Bamford is far more advanced in his career. The stats for 2021 tell you why it was that at the end of that season, he got his first England call-up. The stats for 21-22 tell you why it is that the idea of going to the World Cup is probably becoming a bit of a pipe dream for him. It's not a completely unrealistic dream on the basis that he has been involved with England. But I wrote about him after the Southampton game, and I was saying that because of the way it's gone since his England debut, there is basically no data set on him at all. He just has not played enough games through injury. And if we're being totally honest about last season, and this isn't a Bielsa or Marsh thing, because it happened under both of them. He kept either being pushed or pushing himself to the point where he was breaking down. So there was the game at Newcastle where famously he stayed on the pitch because Bielsa needed him to, even though he had that ankle problem. And it was one of those where somebody's trying to get you through the game, and they got a good point at St James's Park. But then he came back for the Brentford game and pulled the hamstring. Then we had the kind of repetition of the foot injury where he reappeared under Marsh, played for 45 minutes against Norwich, started against Wolves, didn't make it to half time. It's very hard to pin it on him and to say that there's, you know, there is any reason for this other than the fact that his body has just not held up over the past 12 months. But it does leave him and Leeds in a position where, in terms of the World Cup, there's 14 games, that's all, between league games between now and the World Cup. So if he has any chance of getting in, he's got to play. But from Leeds' perspective as well, in order for them to gain proper momentum in the division, they need goals and they need results. And in no small way, they would be looking for those goals to come from him.
I think the disappointment this season with him has been that he obviously had picked up the foot injury at the end of last year, which was an ongoing problem for him. But they said when that happened that there was even a chance for him getting back for the end of the last season. So you thought, well, if that's going to be all healed up pretty much by the end of the season, then he's got a full summer to rest and presumably anything else can kind of get out of his system and he can come back actually fully fit. And then to see him injured pretty much instantly, it does feel like we're headed into the territory of you can't rely on him anymore and you need to replace him.
That's the worry in worst case scenario, isn't it?
He had quite a bad bout of COVID at the end of last season, which was why he missed the Brentford game. Otherwise, I think he would have been in the squad for that. Although I always very much got the impression that had Leeds been safe before the end of the season, there would have been absolutely no point in thinking about using him, given what had gone on. But you've seen it through the summer and you've seen it through pre-season, the fact that he wasn't involved against Blackpool. He wasn't injured, but he wasn't involved because they were just being careful with him. It wasn't cracking the whip for 90 minutes. And I think, you know, there was that kind of sense of relief after the Cowie game that he'd got through 90 and he was looking good. But even then, Marsh was saying, you know, not 100% and not still not at perfect level, but getting close and starting to creep in that direction. And then I thought he had a decent game against Wolves, first day of the season, got through a good 84, 85 minutes, but then has this injury against Southampton. And you find yourself going back to September and that 1-1 draw against Newcastle to find the last time that he played from start to finish in a competitive game. And one of the things that jumped out from the piece that Stuart James did with him on The Athletic last week, it was a chat between Bamford and Michael Doherty, who was his old teammate in Nottingham Forest and is retired from professional football now. The piece was kind of looking at the way in which their lives have gone in different directions, but they're still very close friends and what it's like for the two of them. And towards the end, it got on to talking about the World Cup. Could Bamford go? Does he have any chance? And you can tell that he'd love to, and you can tell that he knows that it's probably now or never for him because he's had this kind of brief in under Southgate. But he did say, in my head, I'm really thinking, where is the next goal coming from? And I can totally understand that because he hasn't had a goal in competitive circumstances at any point since the beginning of December, December the 5th, I think it was, against Brentford. That is a long, long time. And that is kind of the mantra of goal scorers the world over, isn't it? Where's the next one coming from?
Somebody else who's in the squad who's going to have an eye on the World Cup, Rodrigo, is he now the default number nine? Has he found himself in that position and can he actually retain it, do you think?
Well, that's a bit of a trend right the way through the squad. There are a lot of players who will be thinking to themselves that if the form is particularly good over the next few months or if things fall into place, if circumstances open the door, they might get a look in. And I certainly think Rodrigo is one of them. I think if he was to score a decent number of goals before the World Cup, then there would probably be quite a high chance of him knocking on the door and getting into the Spain squad. Llorente has been in and out of it a bit the last couple of years, Robin Koch with Germany and Mateusz Kluk with Poland. I actually think that alongside Bamford, there probably is as good a chance of Jack Harrison getting a look in with England in the build-up. He is somebody Southgate has looked at quite a lot. His stats have been very good at the start of this season. It's not to say he'll get a sniff. It's not to say he'll get a chance. But I think in the circumstances, given that he is sort of on the fringes of the England radar, or has been, and he is fully fit and he's playing, you know, he's delivering the numbers that he's delivered in the first two games, he almost seems better placed. I think with Bamford, I feel sorry for him because it just seems that at the point where it really did open up for him internationally, the doors closed very, very quickly and almost entirely because of his fitness.
What does your forward line look like on Sunday then? Do we go Rodrigo up top? Who's behind him?
I think I put Rodrigo in. I can't see him not starting, and whether or not maybe we see Aronson then play centrally and
Dan James
or Sinisterra maybe getting a, I think maybe a bit early for Sinisterra, but I can see James coming in there maybe.
That feels right. I think that's probably what will happen. It didn't go unnoticed at all at Southampton that although James was up front before half time, there was a deliberate shift at the break to shift Rodrigo up into the nine position and to move Dan James out wide and to put Aronson centrally. I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that I wondered whether longer term Aronson in that central role might be where he fits best. But I think a few reasons for not pulling Rodrigo out. One will be that he's got three goals and, you know, he looks full of it. Second is that Marsh needs a captain and that's clearly who he wants to give the armband to. Gilhart has had this dead leg, although he sounds like he'll absolutely be fit for the weekend. But I think it doesn't seem like circumstances where Marsh would particularly make that change. And there certainly isn't going to be a new striker in before the weekend. I mean, we didn't go into that in great detail, but I did think it was, again, a case today of Marsh saying, look, I would like one. Yeah, I would like one.
It's as close as you're going to get to a challenge, isn't it? Saying, come on, we need to get this done.
Well, again, it's what we were saying earlier. It's just kind of honest reaction to it rather than saying, well, you know, we're probably all right. If that's how you feel and you think that there is scope for one, there is room for one, or there is call for one, then, you know, why not say that without being ridiculously confrontational? Because you couldn't say that Leeds haven't supported him with signings this summer. They definitely have.
He said that, didn't he, as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's that nuance, isn't it, between he's not having a go, but he's making himself plain. You know, I would like one. And he was asked about Wilfried Nonto at FC Zurich. Michael and I were talking about this on Monday, and I was saying that, having asked Leeds about it, they've been very kind of cool on it and kind of been given the impression that if it was going to happen, it might not happen in this window. But in any case, that would not be something that was being looked at as the answer to, do we need a striker for the first team squad? And when Marsh was asked about that today, he said, I don't think he's Premier League ready. And did actually say himself, I don't know if it'll be in this window. Nonto is out of contract at the end of this season. All of the clubs who've been interested are looking at him seem to feel that the asking price Zurich would like or what they're trying to chase is too high for him, you know, that they don't want to spend too much on him. So nothing has really moved on that front. But in any case, that doesn't seem as if that is going to be the one, even if it was to arrive in this window, that doesn't seem like the one that is going to fill the gap, you know.
It feels a bit like sign him and loan him out, does that? Because he's got the full Italy cap. So he's going to want to be playing. He's not going to necessarily be playing at Leeds.
Development player, isn't it? You know, that's how it sounded. Similar to guys like Sonny Perkins, who they signed, Jabby, others who've gone out on loan, Lewis Bate. I mean, I know Creswell came through the academy. So the Jamie Shackleton, but it's the same thing that applies. Mm. You know, you're not wanting, and Shackleton is different because Shackleton is quite clearly coming to the end of his time at Leeds. I think we can all see that. But with Creswell, you've got him. You don't feel like he's yours for the here and now. You want to rely on other centre-backs, so you send him out to play. And I think that would be the same with Nonto. But if it's a striker who Marsh wants to use now and to use this season, then it's going to have to be somebody else.
Well, on that, is it time to start, not succession planning, maybe it's not the right word for Bamford, but have a credible alternative who isn't going to block the pathway for Gilhart? We've heard that, you know, said by people at the club repeatedly over the course of the last few weeks. They don't want to block his pathway. But we've heard very clearly, very definitively today, he does want another attacker. So where's that sweet spot then? Is it as hard as they're making it sound? To someone who's about, I don't know, 25, 24, something like that?
It does feel like we're potentially putting too much on Bamford coming back as well, because he's been at the club, this is his fourth year now, and essentially he's had one season that people have been happy with, because in the Championship, people wanted Tyler Roberts to play ahead of him at one stage, and he missed a lot of chances. And I think coming into the Premier League, having signed Rodrigo, I think a lot of people, myself included, probably thought, well, this is maybe where Bamford moves to the bench for a little while and, you know, has to fight for his position back. But then he started the season brilliantly under Bielsa, eventually worked his way into the England setup, and it just looked like he was a different player for a time, but maybe that was the exception rather than the rule.
He was really good in the Championship. I still maintain that I think Bielsa did the right thing by pinning his colours to that mast. He was absolutely integral to the way Leeds played, and a really big contribution. And I get that there were the missed chances in it, but it wasn't as if it was a season without goals from him. And, you know, he was a very, very key part of a team who in the end won the title at a canter, you know. I say a canter, I mean, okay, it was all bunched up towards the end. But, you know, there's a big gap between them in second place when it came round to it. And he was very, very good in his first season in the Premier League. And so Michael's right to a degree that, you know, you haven't got a massive sample size to go on with Bamford. But I think that he would have had a much better season last season had it not been for his body letting him down. But absolutely, you have to avoid putting too much pressure on him. And that was what I came away from Southampton thinking, that if Bamford is a little short still, and if he is having to be managed, and Marsh had talked about, you know, reducing or limiting his training load through the week leading up to Southampton, then another body in the squad kind of takes the pressure off him, because it's not all on Bamford to score goals, or it isn't too heavily on Bamford to score goals, which isn't to say that he wouldn't want to do that and that he wouldn't have the ambition of finishing as the club's top scorer, because naturally he would. But it does remove that kind of stress. I think as well it gives Marsh a full complement of players, so that if his tactics are going to work, they can work as well as they possibly can, because he's got cover in all areas. It just seems like insurance to me, which can't be a bad idea.
For Bamford's health in the longer term as well, if there's not the pressure on him to maybe play when he's 80% fit and then pick up another injury, that's got to be a good thing, because it feels like we're always at the point of thinking, well, if we can squeeze an hour out of him, then he'll play a game, when actually that's probably not ideal if you're carrying injuries.
It's competition as well, isn't it? I like the idea that Rodrigo is finally getting into the goal, so suddenly there might actually be the question, say for the sake of argument, that Marsh wants to wait a little bit, wants to wait a little until a little later in the season to give Gilhart a proper go, you know, as a starting player up front. In the meantime, it's nice to think that it wouldn't be a foregone conclusion about do you go for Bamford or do you go for Rodrigo in that position. If Rodrigo's scoring goals, then it becomes much more difficult to bump him out. But again, 3 goals from Rodrigo in the first 2 games, it's an encouraging return, and it's nice to think that, yes, he might click, but we've had 2 fairly mediocre seasons from him, and it's just the risk factor, isn't it? It's the risk factor of, will Rodrigo ultimately have a mediocre season again, or is he going to explode? If he explodes in a positive way, then perhaps you don't miss another forward so much. But if there are issues with Bamford's fitness, and if, you know, Rodrigo goes off the boil at any stage, then do you have the cover and the competition that you need?
I think from a fan's perspective, that there are fears around the club's approach because of how it approached last season. So, you know, you've also got fears attached to what Angus Kinnear said when I spoke to him on the Square Ball podcast, that the club can't afford to have expensive transfers go wrong and not work. So you fear maybe they're a little bit risk averse. There's also fears around the kind of the hipster money ball approach, if you like, you know, towards signing players. And sometimes people will say, just go out and get somebody who, you know, is going to work, who's going to be competent at Premier League level. And then you also look at the squad and you see there's like Rasmus Christiansen there, who's a credible alternative to Luke Ayling. Adams and Rocker, credible alternative to Forshaw. So they're starting to just, you know, to build the squad now. And then you see that the money was apparently there for De Ketelaere. And then we also see the injury records of Bamford and Gelhart as well. And people piece all these things together and say, well, just go spend that money on a credible alternative to Patrick Bamford and give yourself the best chance of staying up.
Or don't even go and spend all that money. It doesn't have to be a £35 million striker just because that's what De Ketelaere cost or was going to cost, you know, and what Leeds had agreed with Bruges. And yeah, I think it is all about covering your bases, isn't it? And a little bit like the central midfielder last season, we kind of go around in circles with this. We could touch on left back as well. But to look at specifically at centre forward, it does feel as if what Marsh called last weekend the last decision to make. And he, I thought, made very plain today that they're not going to do a left back. I thought he 100% made it clear that he's happy with Firpo. He thinks Strike's getting better there. He likes what he sees from Helder in the 21. He thinks they can cope and they can manage in that position. But he was saying last weekend, you know, last decision was the striker. Saying today it would be better if we had one, but it's got to be somebody who fits. As he put it, who is that guy? But that's not a question for us, really, is it? It's a question for the recruitment department.
But he did also mention about dominoes falling as well, which suggests to me they've got their eye on maybe one or two players, but other things need to move in the market. Like last year with, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo arriving over at Old Trafford, freed up Dan James.
Absolutely, which will definitely happen. I mean, I don't think I'm sticking my neck out too much to say that Old Trafford is probably one of the places where you're going to see a lot of movement towards the end of the window, or they would probably like to see a lot of movement. And that will have knock-on effect elsewhere. That will mean that transfers start happening elsewhere and players become available. So he's never broken from the line of them being active, Marsh. He's always said that, you know, that they're still looking, they're still doing this, that and the other. He did say today, I think there will be movement. And I just get the sense that deep down, he knows that it would be a good idea to do it if they can. If they can find the right player, to use his phrase, then, you know, why not?
Do Do you think we've got enough at left back?
No.
Is the right answer.
I'm not. I think of Hilda as a centre back predominantly, which isn't to say that he can't play at left back, but in no way have I seen enough of him at first team level in that area to know for sure that he'd be good enough there. I'm not saying that he wouldn't be, but I couldn't say that categorically.
But Kai Wagner, there's talk there.
Well, I think Leeds are one of the clubs who like the look of him, but I was speaking to American guys earlier this week and they're saying there'd be no bids for him. I think Philadelphia Union, where he plays, are increasingly of the view that somebody is going to come in and sign him or might well. But certainly as of yesterday, when I was speaking to one of our American writers, Sam, he was saying, no, there'd been no offers. And I mean, I don't know if we've got the Marsh quote to hand exactly what he said, but he was essentially saying, yeah, so here, I think Pascal's doing great. Junior is looking strong in rehab training. Leo Hilda's played well in the under-21s. There didn't seem to be any vibes in that of, yeah, we need a left back and we're going to go out and get one. I think there was a definite distinction between that and what was being said about a striker.
It's funny you're talking about the striker and the idea of insuring yourself against failure. It was Nick Harris, who is Sporting Intelligence at Sporting Intel on Twitter, who has worked out, and it's actually uncanny how this works, there's a correlation between the number of goals you score and the number of points you get in a season. Nearly every season, it roughly works out. There are some outliers, of course, like, you know, you get Wolves who finished quite high last season, despite not scoring many goals. But generally, it follows that for every goal you score, you'll get a point. And I've had a look at it here. When we finished ninth in the first season back, we scored 62 goals. We got 59 points. Last season, we scored 42. We got 38. So you can tell it's roughly within the same sort of ballpark. And this season, obviously, we've scored four, very small sample size, scored four, got 4 points. So it does actually, by and large, track when it comes to the league table. So okay. Even if you get...
I should actually, in that case, on that basis, I should just finish the point I was going to make, and it was my fault for getting sidetracked. But Strike, I've said a few times, I actually think he tries to do the right things at left back. I genuinely do. I think he's really professional in the way that he tries to apply it all. I'm just not convinced that that is his position. And Firpo is Firpo. We all feel the same about Firpo. We're all a bit unconvinced, yeah? Because of the evidence that we've got over. One season behind him, so we'll see this year. So I think there is an argument that they need a left back. However, if you were giving me the money to spend and telling me that I could only get one player, I would go for a forward.
Yeah, because the goals are going to equate to points. And the point I was just going to finish on there to round it off was that if you add 7 goals to this side, look at how bunched up it was from around 9th to 17th last season in the table. And if it does track and 7 goals is 7 points in a very simplistic way, you're talking about multiple league positions and you're talking about £3 million per league place now. So it's worth doing, isn't it?
Well, that was the incredibly frustrating thing about last season was I never felt at any stage that Leeds needed to be vastly better to be in less trouble than they were in. It didn't feel as if it needed too much to take a bit of a step away so that, you know, far from catching masses of the teams above you, you were at least able to leave a few behind you to get on with the mess of a relegation battle, as opposed to looking yourself like you were going to go down on the last day. And that was kind of my hope for this season, was that the improvement didn't need to be astronomical in order for Leeds to be a mid-table side who were more comfortable. And I think the best thing you can say about the two games so far is that Leeds should probably have won both and should probably have taken 6 points from both. And that is a definite sea change from most of last season, but certainly Marsh's 12 games in charge, where it was quite often difficult to make the case that Leeds had been the better side on the day. I don't think with any, I know how the last half hour went down, the last 20 minutes went down in Southampton, but Leeds looked good for an hour. And I think they had enough of the game against Wolves to deserve that win too.
If you're into your tactics and football analytics and you're looking for a deeper understanding of the game, you can join me, Ali Maxwell, along with Michael Cox and the rest of the Athletic's data team for our Football Tactics podcast. Find new episodes every week on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Funny, I was listening to you two talking on the Monday show, and Michael asking you, Phil, about whether you were looking forward to the end of the transfer window. I've sort of now got a handle on why you hate it so much, because we do, it's like Groundhog Day, isn't it? We go round and round on the same points over and over again. Do keep listening.
It's been a long one, this, because they were in for the Aaronson signing, you know, in no time after the end of the season. We ran that story on the Sunday about 2 hours after the end of the Brentford game, and it's just kept going and going and going from there, and there've been loads and loads of players linked. And they have done a decent number of transfers, including some under 21s. But it's been a busy old window.
What's your take on the net spend thing? Because one of the big things that fans get annoyed about, if you are to follow things on Twitter, is, well, we've not spent a penny this summer. We've taken the money from Rafinha and Phillips, and we've spent that, but they're not spending anything else. Spend more.
Net spend doesn't matter if your squad is adequate. Net spend is relevant if your squad is inadequate. I see an awful lot of messages aimed at our Liverpool writers about net spend over at Liverpool. It seems to be a very, very big topic of conversation over there. And there seems to be quite a lot of criticism of Liverpool's board and their transfer policy from time to time, which strikes me as pretty odd when you consider what they were in for last year and how close they were to doing all four trophies and the sort of players that they've signed. I think you need to be careful that you don't get stuck in the mindset of equating expenditure with guaranteed results. But there are circumstances in which clubs don't spend enough. Absolutely. The proof of the pudding with this will be the season, won't it? If Leeds have another really difficult season and struggle again and either go down or run close to relegation, then you will say the squad wasn't right, the recruitment wasn't right. If they're far more stable and they're far more comfortable, which hopefully they will be, then you would look back at it and say, actually, in the large part, they did the right things in the positions where they needed to sign players. But as part of that discussion with Radrizzani, he was talking about, you know, the money that had been spent on players in the previous two seasons and the fact that they hadn't used player sales in order to bring people in. And I think, in fairness to them, if you were talking net spend over the Premier League windows, they'd be it would be a positive spend, wouldn't it, as opposed to a negative spend. But we did say, or I did say to him, the question that leads to is, has the recruitment been good enough? You know, has it worked? The players that you signed post-promotion, have enough of them thrived and contributed big performances, you know, regularly to say that, yeah, recruitment's worked? And he, as good as said, well, no, not really, but I would rather that we judged over a period of 3 to 5 years how far the club have progressed so that you can say, irrespective of, you know, individual signings, has the whole project and has the whole plan taken them to a better place 5 years down the line than where they were when they got promoted? And time will tell. But in terms of net spend, I'm not saying that people shouldn't discuss it. It's just that it's not necessarily a problem in every circumstance, if that makes sense.
Are we just far too entitled as football fans? Is that the problem? I mean, I was going to say, because no. you were saying that about this idea of people wanting, like, you know, new money, and that made me think of the Man United Supporters Trust comments this last week. Have you seen those? Where they've essentially... Is demanded too strong a word? Let's say demanded. They've demanded that new money be put in for players and infrastructure. And I thought, well, who actually pumps in a load of new money for rebuilding a stadium? And nobody does. Look at Spurs. Spurs have built the best football stadium on the planet, but it also incurred £1 billion worth of debt. But they're paying it through stuff that they have generated by being in the Premier League. And the idea, as we know from the plans at Leeds, is to grow your revenues, then you can start increasing your wage bill, you know, retain the better players and hopefully move away from the so-called Leicester model. But Spurs did it with £1 billion worth of debt, but they don't seem to be struggling too much. I mean, so why do football fans think that they deserve new money?
This is not really a battlefield, but...
Funny though, isn't it?
Michael was trying hard not to giggle about it on Monday. The one observation I would make about Manchester United is that there's a huge amount of money going out of that club, and there is a huge amount of money, from how it appears, being made by the Glazers, at a time when their competitive level seems to be shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So I understand the frustration with that. I think it becomes entitlement if you are of the view that you should be able to sign whoever you want. So basically, if Mbappe suddenly becomes the best player in the world, or Haaland, if you feel like your club should get them, or you should be winning everything every season, or going close to winning everything every season, that feels like bordering on the point of forgetting that football can be a little bit random, that football doesn't deliver everything that you want, and you have to take a kick in the teeth every now and again. You asked, are football fans too entitled? Football fans pay a lot of money to follow football. They do pay a lot of money to travel, pay a lot of money to go to games. So are 100% allowed to judge and take a view on what they see? I think all of us try hard to be as reasonable as we can. But, you know, I find it with Hearts, you become far more, I don't know if irrational is the word, that's probably not fair, but you become a bit, I find myself becoming a bit more hot-headed and a bit less reasonable when I think about things that go wrong at Hearts, you know. Because it is the supporter in me, and perhaps I think too much, you know, as a journalist when it comes to Leeds and kind of look at it through journalist eyes. But no, people are entitled to have expectations. And don't forget as well that clubs quite often promote themselves as being ambitious and progressive. And Leeds talk about wanting 60,000 seat stadium, talk about wanting to develop into a club who are going to compete in Europe, you know, going to develop on all fronts. So therefore, people are going to look for it, aren't they? And people are going to want to see it. But you have to say that there are realistic timeframes in which that can happen. And this is only a club who were promoted 2 years ago. Let me ask you another question. How would you feel if Leeds had come up and had spent or had committed 44 million quid, 45 million quid to Morgan Gibbs-White?
Mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. I think I would have been pleased that we're spending money, because it's just that it's the childish monopoly thing, isn't it? It's like going around the board, snapping up all the properties just because you can.
I'm not saying that's a bad signing, or I don't like him as a player, because I do think he's a really talented player, but I think
it's a lot of money to commit.
I think it does pose a question about football when a club who have been promoted after such a long time outside the division are able to spend that, and happy and comfortable to spend that. It's a huge amount of cash, and football is just a mad world. It's absolutely a mad world.
To look at Forest, because they've signed every player this summer, it feels like they've signed in a player every day, more or less. What is going to happen to them if they do go down? Like, how do they make all of this fit with EFL financial rules?
Or even, Phil, year three in the Premier League, if they make it that far, you know, like, because that's when you're rolling 3 year FFP kicks in, doesn't it?
Well, they're going to have massive expenditure to deal with, aren't they? And somebody's going to have to pick up the bill, and players would have to be sold. But I suppose, to be fair to Forrest, talking about that two games into the season is sensible in as much as you're taking a long-term view of it, and you are thinking, you know, how protected is the club? But it goes back to the whole thing about proof being in the pudding. If Forest have a really strong season and the team develops, people will look back at the summer and say, yeah, because they invested. You know, they spent money and they pushed the boat out. They developed the team. They improved the squad. Therefore, they had a good season. If they have a bad season, terrible season, go down, or a bad season, just about get relegated, people will say they were doing what they shouldn't have been doing when they came up.
We kind of reverse engineer our opinions based on what actually ends up happening, don't we? Because we're always sort of operating looking backwards, if you like.
So the question I ask about Gibbs-White, and you can't answer this, obviously, but do you have the money to do a deal like that? Do you have the money? If you do, then absolutely fine and all well and good if it's part of a strategy. If you're spending that without much plan of how you're going to absorb the cost and everything else, then you are kind of setting yourself up for trouble further down the line. But it has to be said that if you end up in the Premier League and a club like Forest are devoting that amount of cash to a transfer like that, what do you do but apart from try and get involved at the same sort of level? It's really, really difficult, isn't it? That's why I sort of thought if Rocca and Christensen could end up being very good signings for £10 million, perhaps Leeds have landed on a couple of really good bargains there at a time when clubs seem less and less bothered about bargains. But the word bargain just doesn't seem to come into it anymore, really. You pay what you have to pay, and I know that's kind of how it goes.
Although Leeds do seem to run a little bit counter to that, and I think on the one hand, people do like that we're not just going completely gung-ho. But there is, as I say, that entitled, maybe the childish part of you wants to go full football manager and blow the budget on everyone.
If I owned a club, I'd want to do that. Except then I'd remember that it was some of it might well be my money, and it might be me picking up the bill.
I think as well, part of the thing of getting promoted to the Premier League was that there's 120 million quid to spend every year, isn't there? That seems to be part of the deal that you get. And in reality, I guess when you come up, everything inflates around it. So all the way, people who were paid 20 grand in the Championship has only paid 40 grand, and that it all starts eating away. And this summer, I get the feeling the wage bill has probably grown as we've grown the squad, even though a couple of big earners in Phillips and Rafinha have gone. The wages they were on were probably, in truth, not reflective of their ability nor their new contract.
No, yeah, I was going to say, you're right there on the wage bill. I think a lot of people do always say, well, we get 150 million quid a year.
I was thinking about this, Hill, in the week, and I wish I'd dug out the figures, but the wage bill...
It is the wage bill, isn't it?
...going over 100 million. Yeah. So straight away you can go... And that's not just for the players. You know, you've got a club that needs staff and infrastructure and everything else.
Two-thirds of your Premier League money goes on wages, doesn't it?
Shoots out the door. And how do you avoid that? On the basis that if you want expensive players, you have to pay them expensive wages, and there's a going rate. And players... You know, some players will be reasonable about taking slightly less one club if that's where they particularly want to go. Some players will just expect that for the value you're paying or the value you're putting them at, you pay X amount. I mean, I always remember somebody saying to me that when Leeds used to talk about Robert Snodgrass being worth £10 million, £12 million, Snodgrass's attitude was, well, why don't you pay me the wage of a £12 million player then, if that's what you think I'm worth? You know, pay me the going rate. And same, somebody like Cucurella, for example, coming from Brighton to City, if you're signing him for the same money as Haaland, I'm not saying he'll be on... Well,
is it Chelsea now?
Yeah, sorry, Chelsea, yeah. If you're signing him for the same money as Haaland, say, for example, because the fees were pretty... In fact, I think Cucurella in the end went for more, and okay, it was because of the buyout for Haaland. But there's a kind of rough ballpark going rate, isn't there, of what you have to pay. So your wage bill does go through the roof. But as I say, none of this changes the fact that you should still put pressure on a club to be as good as they can be, to push themselves as far as they can. And it can't be a one-sided thing where a club talk about expanding the stadium, going to Europe and everything else, but supporters are not then entitled to push them to make that step. As I say, when they got promoted, Radrazzani always kind of talked about that as a five-year process of making Europe. I think that seems like a pretty reasonable timescale to do it in. I think to be looking for it to happen, irrespective of the league position in season one, I think looking for it to happen in the space of 2 years or even three is asking quite a lot.
With that in mind, then, when are we going to give Jack Harrison a new contract, Phil? Pay him what he's worth.
I was expecting that to get going after the window closes. I don't see him leaving. Radrazzani said absolutely not. When we spoke to him and asked him about Newcastle, he said no way, that will not happen. If Harrison is serving up the number of assists and chances and crosses, and it's quite clear as well that he's going to be a really influential part of the set piece approach. If he's a fundamental player in this squad, if he's crucial, his contract can't be allowed to run down much further. So no, you would expect that's going to happen. Otherwise, it will start to look more and more like he's on his way somewhere further down the line.
And just wrapping up the other stuff then, in terms of outgoings of the squad players, we've seen Stuart McKinstry go back north of the border to Motherwell on loan, back where it all started. No permanent option in that one?
No permanent option. I don't think Motherwell will be paying a huge amount of money for that either. It's a case of getting him a game and letting him play. I was saying in the notes, there has been, it was kind of promised this and telegraphed, but there has been a definite shift in the attitude towards loan offers. He's one of several players who've gone out, Roberts, Shackleton, Creswell, Lewis Bate as well. There has been definite movement from it's better to have them under the umbrella of the first team, which is what Bielsa wanted, to it's better for them to get games elsewhere. I think the one to look for now will be Poveda and see what happens with him.
Yeah, Marsh mentioned him today, didn't he, in the presser. We will provide a solution for Jan Poveda, who has been a pleasure to work with after his injury, but at least a loan move for him, it looks like.
Yeah, I would think so. He doesn't look like he's going to get a look in the first team.
Not Matteo Joseph, though. He is going to be inching closer to the first team, according to Marsh.
They like him and were very, very happy with that signing when they made it. I know back in January, it wasn't as if there were parties in the street when he arrived from Espanyol, I think it was. It was players of a slightly different calibre and their age and experience that everybody was looking for in the market. But they were really pleased with that one. And he does seem like he's, like an awful lot of the players in the 23s, he seems like he's got plenty of talent. Good things being said about Sonny Perkins as well.
Kun Tumeniskov, off?
Yes.
Fourth tier of Spanish football there.
Yeah, he, again, has not been getting a look in for a long time. That's very kind of reminiscent or harks back to the initial approach to the academy after Radrazzani's takeover, where Orta's strategy was to bring in a lot of players from abroad and players who he obviously rated and thought might have a chance here, but a lot of whom haven't really thrived. That's not to say that's true of all of them. I mean, Stroik came in that flood of players too, but it's definitely changed. The strategy has definitely moved towards a far more recruitment, UK-based recruitment at academy level. And also a bit more expenditure on individual players. I think they've tried to push the envelope on that front.
And the nature of under-21's recruitment is that you get two or three from each batch, don't you, that are half decent.
And if it works, even if they're not breaking through into your first team, the financial gains from this as well, potentially. I mean, I'd have a look at what City have managed to do with the players who've left the Etihad this summer.
How much have they brought in? Is it like 120 million or something?
When we were sat down at Southampton, we were talking about Bazunu and Lavia, who were in the Southampton team, and Jabby, who'd obviously come over from City to Leeds, and saying that between them, you were talking about income of around about £40 million. And it might not be fair to say that they had no chance of playing for City ever, but it felt like they had a long road to go down if they were going to break into that, you know, break into Guardiola's squad in a way that made them first team regulars. And the cash that's been pulled in from that has, give or take, paid for Haaland's transfer fee. Okay, there's a bit of a difference between it. But that's pretty extraordinary when you think about it. And actually, I'm always fascinated to see the number of clubs who don't just spend and spend and spend. You know, it interests me that City didn't bother with Cucurella in the end because they clearly thought it was too much money and they didn't want to do it. So
they don't need a left back, Phil, so, just like Leeds.
That must be it. That must be it. Yeah, they've got a centre back who can play there too. But they pulled out of that and gave up on it because it was a case of this is not the right thing to do. And as I say, even City, you look at and you think, well, they have actually used outgoing transfers to to fund a bit of what they've done. Well,
I've got them here. They've brought in, according to Wikipedia, I mean, so, you know, take it with a pinch of salt, but over 164 million quid they've brought in this summer. 12 million for Bazuna. He's gone to Southampton. There's players in here I've never heard of, though, like Pedro Porro, who's gone to Sporting. 7.2 million there. You've got 4.3 on Ko Itakura, who's a Japanese player who's gone to Mönchengladbach. Never heard of that player. Obviously, they sold Gabriel Jesus to Arsenal, 45. We paid 5 for Jarby. Lavia to Southampton, over 10.
Sterling as well. I mean, yeah. him and Jesus, you can kind of strike out with that list.
But Zinchenko. But I mean, even still, they're just nicely supplemented with 10, 20, 30 yeah, million pounds every summer, don't
absolutely.
They?
It's almost like having a massive financial advantage gives you a massive advantage.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not joking when I say that Leeds have an eye on their academy constantly. There are so many good players in it that you've got scouts from everywhere who are just keeping an eye on it. If in the case of Leeds, as they did when Phillips left, or Southampton with Lavia, Bazunu, you know, if the opportunity comes up, there's no shortage of takers for them because the academy ranks there are so good.
Well, there you go then. That's the Friday show all wrapped up for this week, the Phil Hay Show. At the Phil Hay Show on Twitter to say hello, and pound a month for 6 months at theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Let's reconvene after Chelsea then, shall we? And we'll debrief that and see how we got on. What are you fancying for that then? Home win?
Are we doing predictions this season? I
why,
can't remember.
Why did you laugh? Why did you Michael just snorted with laughter.
I don't see a home win.
It's a bigger test, this one, isn't it? And I must be honest, I think I fancy Chelsea.
I'll take a point.
Yeah.
Take a point. We'll return on Monday. Speak to you then. Bye-bye. The Phil Hay Show.